I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Did you happen to live through that television spectacle that was the O.J. Simpson trial? I did, and I'm afraid I'll never get that time back. But trials are attempts to get at the truth, and so I'm usually in favor of them. We're going to hear the story of another historic trial that goes back even further in time than the O.J. story. This one is not a whodunit. We know whodunit. The whole world witnessed the shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby. What makes this story interesting, I think, is how this trial brought so many of society's deep fears and concerns right to the fore. You know, when collective fears, well-founded fears or unfounded fears, when they take root in our hearts, we become susceptible to a vast array of theories and speculation. Conspiracy theories will abound. Paranoia can seize us. During the Cold War, in those days following a presidential assassination, something as simple as this man shot that man on camera can suddenly mushroom into a whirlwind of speculation and competing and highly contentious narratives. David Fisher knows a lot about the Jack Ruby trial. He's author of more than 80 books, many of them New York Times bestsellers, and together with Dan Abrams, David Fisher is co-author of the book Kennedy's Avenger, Assassination, Conspiracy, and the Forgotten Trial of Jack Ruby. He's on the line with us right now. David Fisher, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, I have only seen the famous stills, but this shooting actually happened on TV, carried live?
It did indeed. CBS had its cameras there, and they were broadcasting the movement of Lee Harvey Oswald from the police station downtown when Ruby appeared out of nowhere and shot him. And within a minute or 2 minutes later, NBC was showing a tape of the same shooting. So this, within minutes, became the crime with the most eyewitnesses in history. And it's really important to remember this was the beginning of television. Television had become ubiquitous only a couple of years earlier, where everybody could afford a television. So this was arguably the single greatest event ever seen on television to that moment.
So given the circumstances of the filming, absolutely no question about the perpetration of this crime. We do know it was Jack Ruby, and that you would think that that would be just a case closed.
Well, you know, one of the Dan Abrams and I have done a series of books about great trials that most people don't know about, and this is the fourth one in the series. And one of the things that comes through in each of the books is what seems obvious is by law is the furthest thing from reality. Law and reality is determined by a group of people sitting in a courtroom, not by any written statutes.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, we've heard the arguments over and over again that you want a fair trial and everybody needs their day in court if they're going to be charged, you know, with a crime, and there's going to be a defense that is mounted. When you look at this whole story, before we get into the details, do you think all of that energy was worth it?
Boy, that's a good question. Worth it to whom? Worth it to the system? Probably. Only in that it opened debate about what the court system, what the legal system is supposed to do. It unfortunately also was the beginning of the entire conspiracy industry, which came right out of the trial. And in that sense, you have to wonder if it was worth it. And the interesting thing is that it was unnecessary, which most people don't know is the Texas law, because it was the Texas law, forgave essentially passionate killings. The penalty for an unplanned homicide like this one was 5 years in prison. That's all, 5 years, generally 2 years served. So Jack Ruby could have been out of prison within 2 years if he had a different lawyer.
Oh, you've already mentioned the lawyer. So let's bring up that name. Who was he? Where did he come from? It seems like there was a real character.
Well, again, this was this time, the point we make in the book is that a lot of things were coming together at this time. This was the America, post-war America, entering the new reality. In addition to television, we had created the celebrity lawyer. Until that point, the only lawyer that most Americans had ever heard of was Clarence Darrow. But suddenly in the late 50s, lawyers like Louis Neiser, who was a famous litigator, wrote big best-selling books. And lawyers had become celebrities. The two biggest shows on TV at that point were both about lawyers. Perry Mason was one of them. And Melvin Belli was on the cover of magazines. He was the celebrity lawyer, he and F. Lee Bailey. And here was his opportunity in the spotlight. The entire nation was watching this trial, and he was not about to give it up.
Well, how do you even proceed in this kind of a situation? I mean, you got to cast doubt on something, but it's not going to be on the pulling of the trigger.
Well, the question was not if he pulled the trigger, but why he pulled the trigger. No one contested the fact that he had killed Lee Harvey Oswald. But rather than accepting the prosecution's offer of homicide without passion, 2 years essentially, Melvin Belli decided he was going to make a stand. He was going to say that Jack Ruby was crazy when he shot Lee Harvey Oswald. And not just that he was insane, legally insane, he picked an odd part of legal insanity. He focused on something that no one had ever heard of before, what was called a variant, and to make his plea. And the whole concept was that Jack Ruby was not mentally capable of knowing what he was doing when he pulled the trigger because he suffered from this disease, a disease that no one had ever heard of before, literally.
So when I was growing up and I was a kid and we were watching TV shows, there was this notion of temporary insanity. You know that phrase, temporary insanity? Does this all go back to the Jack Ruby trial?
It goes back about 120 years before that. One of the things we do in the book, in these books, is talk about the growth of the American legal system, where all these things that we take for granted come from, the jury system, the grand jury system, the advocate system. You know, in each of these books, we focus on part of them and go into them as kind of anecdotal history, telling the stories. And the concept of temporary insanity was quite old in law, and it was enshrined in British law in the 1830s and 1840s, and was brought into the law in the United States and carried through, and it remains very murky. The concept of being able to claim that for an instant someone was not capable of knowing what they were doing or was not capable of preventing themselves from taking actions is psychologically pretty murky and extraordinarily difficult to prove. It's not like somebody's out and out crazy and all the time crazy. This is saying 99% of the time this person is sane. And in this one instant, for whatever the reasons, he was not. He or she was not.
Now, I want to talk with you about Jack Ruby, who he was, what we know about his biography, what may have been his temperament as people saw him and associated with him. Before we do that, just the time frame, how soon after the Kennedy assassination was Lee Harvey Oswald shot?
Kennedy was shot on Friday, and Lee Harvey Oswald was shot on Sunday. It was really in that same emotional time frame. I'll tell you an interesting story. After the book was published, Dan Abrams and I got a letter from Jack Ruby's granddaughter, in which she was telling us that when she first heard this book was being written, she thought it was just going to be another of several books like this, and in fact was tremendously surprised and pleased that it, the telling. And one of the things she told us that nobody knew is right after the Kennedy assassination, Jack Ruby had called his mother in Chicago and told, and he was in hysterics, and he told her he was coming home from Dallas. And she said, no, you have to stay there. And had that gone differently, had he got on a plane or a train as he wanted to, none of this would have ever happened.
Yeah, how does that make you feel when something like that comes to the light after your book is out?
Well, we love that kind of history. As an aside, at the very last minute, the stars of this trial and that everybody knows about were Jack Ruby and Melvin Belli. But the prosecutor, who nobody remembers or ever heard of, was a guy named Henry Wade. And at the very end, literally as the book was almost going to press, we discovered this incredible piece of historical, a wonderful piece of history. Henry Wade was the defendant in Roe v. Wade. And more than Ruby or anyone else, he's the one whose name resonates today. So those are the kind of things we found as we went along.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a short break, but I do want to hear from you how you size up the character, the demeanor, the personality of a Jack Ruby. He seems like a really intriguing type to consider. We'll do that after this break, as we're visiting with David Fisher. He is co-author of Kennedy's Avenger, Assassination Conspiracy, and the Forgotten Trial of Jack Ruby. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have author David Fisher with us. He is co-author, together with Dan Abrams, of Kennedy's Avenger, Assassination, Conspiracy, and the Forgotten Trial of Jack Ruby. Yeah, paint a picture of Jack Ruby. He ran a nightclub?
Well, yes, he did. And, Dan and I often agree parts of our books. In this case, we tended to disagree. Not that Ruby was less than sane. I think that had became obvious in the book, and I'll explain why in a minute. But exactly what was going on when he fired those shots. Jack Ruby was a wannabe. He was one of these people that many of us run into in our lives, a loud, boisterous, often irritating character. He wanted to be important. He was capable of running a nightclub usually with the help of his sister or somebody else. But he also, and here's where you get into sane or insane, he had a volatile temper, and it exploded. It exploded on many instances where, seemingly for a mild or small provocation, he would get into a fist fight with someone. He He also had dogs. That in itself is not unusual, except that he referred to his dogs as his children. And he didn't mean it as a joke. If anybody called them dogs, he got really angry. They were his children. And one of them wasn't his child. One of them was his wife. And he literally referred to her as his wife. And this was an ongoing thing. It wasn't a joke. There was nothing, we found nothing to indicate that there was any humor involved or any knowledge. This is the way his brain worked. So clearly, he was operating in a different realm of reality. He also, being Jewish, or being half Jewish, was terribly sensitive to the anti-Semitism in Dallas at that point. Dallas was a fascinating place. Air conditioning had come to Dallas less than a decade before, and what it did, as it did to all the southern cities, is it made them accessible for business during the summer. Before that, it was just too hot and too humid, and businesses did not move there. Air conditioning changed that, and Dallas was trying to recreate its image. It was trying to present itself as a forward-thinking, modern city, the capital of the South. That's what it wanted to be. But it also was basically the home of the far right-wing John Birch Society. And one of the heads of the John Birch Society, General Edwin Walker, lived in Dallas. So they were fighting. They were trying to create this image at the same time they were fighting their own history. And this trial, you know, the concept of Kennedy, the President of the United States, coming to Dallas, being welcomed by his Vice President, Lyndon Johnson, this was set up to be a display of the new South, the new Dallas. And it was a political trip for the election in the following year so the Democrats could continue to hold Texas. So all of that was in the background of what was happening when Kennedy arrived. And there was a lot of adverse reaction to Kennedy's visit. Among them was a billboard calling for the impeachment of Earl Warren, then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and an editorial in the Dallas Morning News, or rather an advertisement in the Dallas Morning News, accusing Kennedy of all kinds of heinous crimes. The key was that the billboard and this ad were both signed by someone with a Jewish name. And Ruby interpreted that to be an anti-Semitic effort. And so he was furious at that. He actually went and took pictures of the billboard, went to the post office to find out who owned the post office box that the ad appealed to. So there was that element of it also.
So he's a hothead. He's a social misfit. He's got a temper issue.
And a gun.
And he has a gun. Yeah.
And a gun. This is Texas. As I said, he was emotional. And no one knew what the triggers were that set him off. Oddly, the reason that Dan and I both came to believe that this was not planned, as the prosecution claimed, was that the night before, he had gotten a phone call from one of the women who worked at his strip club, one of the strippers, who needed $25 to pay her rent. And so he agreed to send it to her. So that morning, Lee Harvey Oswald was scheduled to be moved at 10 a.m. At about 25 after 11, Jack Ruby went downtown, bringing with him his wife, his dog, his wife, and he went to the Western Union office. This was an hour and a half after it had been announced that Oswald was going to be moved. He went into the Western Union office and sent the telegram, sent the MoneyGram, $25. He came out of the office and saw there was a big crowd. For whatever reasons, the movement had been delayed. He walked down to the police station. The police knew him because he was always inviting them to his club. And they sort of thought, well, that's Jack. And they let him in. And he pushed his way through and killed Oswald. But he left his dog, his wife, locked in the car. And Dan and I both believed if there's any piece of evidence that shows this was not planned, that was it. He just would never have subjected his dog, his wife, to that treatment, to leaving it in the car, locked in the car in Dallas.
Would you fold in now sort of the big picture of geopolitics? Because we've got the Cold War. We've got fear about what the Soviet Union might be up to. We've got the anti-commie kind of thing going on, right? In all of this, this just seems like a fertile bed for planting seeds of conspiracy theories, and it was bound to happen practically.
Well, you know, I was very fortunate in my career in that at one point I was invited by the FBI into its crime lab, and I spent 6 months inside the FBI crime lab. And among the people I interviewed were all of the people who did the forensic work on the assassination. And I came to believe completely that the stories that came out were accurate. That I am a believer that there was a sole shooter, that he was entirely capable of firing that many shots within that period of time. But bigger than that, I believe that in this country, this is kind of a juxtaposition, in this country, nobody can keep a secret, particularly when it has value. And if there was a conspiracy, by now it certainly would have come out. Somebody would have left something in a safe for a relative, a distant relative, to sell. So I believe that what appears to have happened is what actually happened. Now, conversely, I also believe that there was a conspiracy in the assassination of Martin Luther King, which has never come out. So I contradict myself when I say that. But to your point, there was a strong right-wing presence in Dallas at that moment. And in fact, it later came out, and this is where the whole FBI thing comes in, that Lee Harvey Oswald, only a few months before, had fired a rifle shot into the living room of General Edwin Walker, who was the leader of the far right in Dallas. There also is evidence, and there has never been a reasonable explanation, that Oswald did travel to Mexico City in the months before the assassination. He did visit the Russian embassy there, and no one knows why, and no one knows what came out of that. So all of this kind of came out at the trial and in the inquest, which gave birth to the conspiracy industry.
Yeah, this is a phenomenon, though, that I think has to do with more than just people cooking up reasons. It really, and I said this at the beginning of our conversation, don't you think this has to do with a community, a nation that is so fearful of what's not known in the Cold War that there will be a proliferation of narratives?
Well, I mean, I think you've really nailed it. I think that's absolutely true. I think we have continued to see that throughout history. I think that one of the things that the assassination gave birth to was more than just an industry, but a very profitable industry. And people saw that. They paid attention. There were numerous best-selling books. There have been, how many movies have we, and documentaries have we looked at? And we're still, to some degree, fascinated. The success of this book shows that. And so whenever something has happened since then in this country, there has always been the naysayers. There has always been the other side because there's money in it. That is not to say they don't believe what they say. I'm quite sure many of them do. But I am also quite sure a lot of them are selling T-shirts.
Well, let's get back to Melvin Belli and the conclusion of this trial. He doesn't persuade the jury, does he?
He does not. Although, when I say Dan and I disagreed, he persuaded me. I think there was ample evidence that what he was saying was true. And I am in a very small minority, by the way. But what happened, and it was almost preordained, that the jury very quickly found Ruby guilty of murder. The lawyers appealed, and the basis of the appeal was that at the very beginning of the trial, they had said it would be impossible for Ruby to get a fair trial in Dallas and had asked for a change of venue because, as we said, Dallas was trying to protect its image. And the courts, the Texas courts, later after the guilty verdict, agreed with Belli, with them, that he could not have gotten a fair trial in Dallas, and they threw out the verdict, and a new trial was scheduled. During that time, of his own demands, Ruby not only testified in front of the Warren Commission, he also took a lie detector test. And we've included much of that material in the book. And as you read it, you understand he truly was crazy and was going more and more and more crazy. And before he could be retried, he died of cancer. And so it is accurate to say Jack Ruby died unconvicted of the murder that was seen by several million people.
He was more than just a loose cannon. He was losing his touch on reality.
Well, yeah, and the question becomes when that happened. When you read the transcripts of the trial, which are amazing, and then you read the lie detector test and his testimony in his cell for the Warren Commission, you kind of shake your head at the demons that were running around in his mind.
Well, in conclusion, what kind of a lesson can we draw from all of this? I mean, I mentioned the O.J. Simpson trial, and, you know, when a country becomes completely obsessed with a certain trial and it becomes a media spectacle, and part of that is just so unpalatable to me. I mean, part of me just wants to run away from it, and yet, the dumpster fires we all end up looking at. And I'm wondering if there is some benefit to going back and revisiting these kinds of trials that will not just make the court system better in the future, not just lead to better trials, but somehow be beneficial to society at large in the way we turn things into spectacles.
Well, that's a wonderful wish, but I go back to something I said previously, is there's a lot of money to be made. There are a lot of people who quest after celebrity. You know, I was very fortunate in that several years ago, I worked with Johnny Cochran. I wrote Johnny's memoir, and we became good friends. And this bothered him a tremendous amount also. You know, the public image of Johnny Cochran is so far from the reality of Johnny Cochran and it bears exactly on what you've just said. He did not want to be part of that trial, the Simpson trial. He felt he was forced into it. He understood the celebrity that resulted from it and tried to utilize it in very positive ways. People don't know that Johnny Cochran was a religious, went to church every morning, law and order guy. He was the number three guy in the Los Angeles Police Department. His son is a cop. And Johnny bemoaned the fact that what that trial became. And he understood he was in the middle of it. He understood that what his job as an attorney was, but to say he enjoyed it was wrong. And he anticipated exactly what you've just said, which is things like this do not help the legal system, at least to my point of view, and Johnny felt the same way, but they turn it into theater, which is maybe the worst thing it could be.
Well, if it gets turned into theater, I have to point at the cameras everywhere and cameras in courtrooms and even cameras in legislative bodies and cameras everywhere. If things are going to be turned into theater, that's because we're constantly making theater with our cameras.
Well, it's cheap theater. It's easy to produce. It brings with it great drama. It brings with it, you know, if you get hooked, you stay with it. Because no one knows what the outcome will be. It's like a great baseball game. It is theater. And when you get a showman like Melvin Belli, in this case, who is going to exploit it for personal gain, Melvin Belli was a showman. He embraced the grandeur, his office in San Francisco. He used to have a cannon on the roof of his office, and when he won a case, he would fire the cannon. You know, he was well known as essentially created malpractice law, and got by far the largest verdicts anyone in history had ever gotten by virtue of his showmanship. He was the kind of guy at the beginning of a trial would put a box on the defense table or in front of him, and he would let the jury look at that box throughout the entire trial, guessing what was in it. And then at the end, he would open the box to make his point. But he was a master showman. There was a great entrepreneur and producer at that time who was married to Elizabeth Taylor named Mike Todd. And he was, Melvin Belli was the Mike Todd of the law, larger than life. His best friend was Errol Flynn, and they would gallivant through France together. You know, he was on the cover of Life magazine. And all of this was an opportunity for him to embellish the growing legend in his own mind of Melvin Belli.
Yeah, he's a P.T. Barnum then, I guess.
Yep. So in answer to your question, I agree with you and I bemoan the fact, but that's what we got.
Yeah. Well, I said that was my conclusion. I just have to go to your subtitle, though, The Forgotten Trial of Jack Ruby. Why would we have forgotten this trial?
Well, because, number one, I think it happened so soon after the assassination, and it was all part of this national trauma that we all suffered through. You know, when Dan and I, the first book we did, many people did not know, including myself, that Abraham Lincoln had been the defense attorney in 27 murder trials. We got the transcript of the last one the year before he became president. Teddy Roosevelt, after being president, was on trial. John Adams defended the British soldiers after the Boston Massacre, and now this one. When Dan suggested we do this trial, I realized I didn't even remember it. And I was there. I was old enough to remember it. And I didn't even remember it. And I was sort of startled at that. And as I began talking to other people, they all said, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember. Well, they said they remembered it happened. And I said, but do you remember the outcome? And there would always be this blank look on their face. It got tied up with the Warren Commission, you know, with the Kennedy conspiracy industry. It got all tangled up in all of them, and I was shocked that there had been one book written about the trial right after the trial. But other than that, there was an amazing lack of people looking into it. And it was an important trial. I mean, because it was an effort to bring temporary insanity into the modern courtroom. It was the first show trial. There had been one a couple of years earlier. A doctor in Cleveland killed his wife. That was a major trial, but there was very little television for that. So there was the whole issue of, should television cameras be allowed in the courtroom? The judge eventually, in this case, said no, they should not be, but he let them in to broadcast the verdict.
It just gets swallowed up. I mean, when there's a country in crisis, in turmoil, and living through a long chapter of fearfulness and social unrest, it's just one more thing going wrong, right?
And at the same time, we are ramping up in Vietnam.
Right.
The new president is committing more and more troops and getting us embroiled in that one.
A remarkable story, and you tell it very well. David Fisher, a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
David Fisher with us, together with Dan Abrams. Fisher is co-author of the book Kennedy's Avenger, Assassination, Conspiracy, and the Forgotten Trial of Jack Ruby. Of all the many conspiracy theories swirling around JFK's assassination, one that is plausible, at least on a superficial level, is based on Lee Harvey Oswald's connections to Cuba. Did Castro put Oswald up to it as revenge? Revenge for a failed attempt by the U.S. to topple Castro? Maybe for Kennedy's success in keeping Soviet missiles off of Cuba? One thing's for sure, Kennedy did not shy away from going after Castro, and Castro certainly did not shed any tears for the fallen president. More on Kennedy versus Castro when we come back to Constant Wonder in just a moment. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're talking about some of the consequential threads of history that were spun out right after the assassination of JFK, the Jack Ruby story specifically, the man who wanted to avenge the assassination of Kennedy but actually ended up curtailing the investigation and contributing to a multitude of conspiracy theories thereby. One of those conspiracy theories, among the more plausible actually, is that Cuban dictator Fidel Castro may have played a role. What could Kennedy have done to set off Castro? Well, as Shakespeare once wrote, let me count the ways, although I think that actually comes from a love sonnet. We got the story of antipathy between these two politicians from Jim Johnston, author of Murder, Inc., The CIA Under John F. Kennedy.
The CIA had been trying to assassinate Castro since the August of 1960 under the Eisenhower administration and continued under Kennedy. In fact, the Bay of Pigs invasion was really a fallback to a plan to assassinate him that didn't work. In September of 1963, after the CIA started meeting with this agent who would assassinate Castro, Castro seemed to know and said in a speech, or said to a reporter, an American reporter, that the CIA is trying to assassinate me. If they continue this, they themselves will not be safe, referring to Kennedy. So it seems to me that he either was payback for what had happened to him, or at least a warning shot that might succeed. And, you know, I think you can always put this possibility that in Castro's mind, He didn't have to succeed. He merely had to have someone fire a shot at Kennedy for Kennedy to get the message, pick up. But generally, I think the answer is there probably won't be any proof. But if an intelligence agency conducts an operation, they're pretty professional, and so they try to make sure that all the details are obscured.
So do I detect a hint in your comment there that the Warren Commission maybe wasn't thorough enough?
Yes, most certainly you detect that in my comment. In the book, I really rather severely castigate the Warren Commission, not necessarily that it was their fault, but that the CIA withheld all of this information from them. I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious that if the CIA was meeting with someone to kill Castro at the very minute Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, the Warren Commission should have been told that.
And tell us about the title, Murder, Inc. Where does that come from? There's a story of a reporter who went to LBJ, and I guess Murder, Inc. came out of LBJ's mouth.
Yes, I didn't want that to come out of my mouth. After Johnson had retired from the presidency, and he was down in Texas, a reporter interviewed him, and he said, the reporter asked what Johnson thought of the who killed Kennedy, and Johnson said, well, I think Castro did it. And the reporter said, well, why do you think that? And Johnson said, well, Kennedy was running a Murder, Inc. in the Caribbean, referring to these assassination plots against Castro.
So if there was a Murder, Inc., that's a big project, and of course it's just a metaphor, but how many different discrete attempts do you suppose there may have been on Castro's life instigated by Kennedy?
Well, I think that certainly this final one, and then there were three or four others that the Senate Intelligence Committee identified in its 1975 investigation. You know, the CIA was constantly trying to do it. It's hard to know how close they got. Castro himself, at least according to some books, said that there were 39 attempts to kill him, but those were not only CIA attempts, but disaffected Cubans trying to kill him. So he was constantly facing assassination.
So tell us about your role with the Senate Intelligence Committee, and what was it like for you, more than anything else? What was it like to try to see the unfolding of the details and trying to put the whole picture together, the puzzle together?
That's a good question. My most memorable moment. The committee had done the investigation of plots to assassinate foreign leaders, and so this investigation of the Kennedy assassination came after that. And there was a lot of talk, you know, as there is today, of, you know, grassy knolls and conspiracy theories and sort of these off the wall. And I believe the Warren Commission. I thought that, you know, they had the right conclusion. So I thought that the senators needed to know a little bit about the Soviet Union's dealings with assassins. So I arranged for a briefing of the senators from someone with one of the intelligence agencies to talk about the Soviet assassination operations. It was called, their intelligence agency is the KGB, or ours is the CIA, theirs is the KGB. And they had a Department 13 that specialized in assassinations. And so this witness comes in, and I was a young lawyer, and I said, Mr. Witness, isn't it true that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the kind of man the Soviets would use to assassinate Kennedy? You know, and I thought it'd be a James Bond kind of figure. And the witness said, no, Mr. Johnston, he's precisely the kind of man they would have used. And I just sort of fell out of my seat. And he went on to say the Soviets developed this Department 13 during World War II when their German army was driving into the Soviet Union. And the KGB would leave behind agents to assassinate German officers and sabotage. And they discovered that rational men wouldn't undertake these jobs because they were suicide missions. And so they turned to psychological misfits and people who were mentally ill. And the description of it fit precisely what the Warren Commission talked about Oswald's personality. So that was what this witness was saying. And that was a shock to me, and I think to the senators as well.
So if the Warren Commission was trying to paint a psychological profile of Lee Harvey Oswald as being unbalanced, a psychological misfit, that was all in the interest, perhaps, of saying he was just acting independently and at nobody else's command.
That's correct, because, you know, James Bond movies and books were very popular at the time, and, you know, Sean Connery, who just recently passed away, played that as this super talented assassin who was very professional and intelligent. And so the Warren Commission, in their report, tried to paint Oswald as anything but a James Bond, and they unfortunately painted him to be exactly what the Soviets would have used for an assassin. Now, I don't think the Soviets were behind it, but I think a foreign intelligence agency would have used those same techniques.
Well, I'd like to turn the rest of our conversation into a discussion with you about the nature of a president's relationship with our intelligence community, the CIA in particular. Ever since I was a kid and have learned about this kind of stuff, it just has seemed so wrong to me that these covert operations, I mean, I've grown up with it, we all have, and I guess we just kind of turn a blind eye to it sometimes, but I don't think in a democracy we can do that. I'm wondering how you would square, the democratic kind of society with even having, I know for national security purposes, you're going to have a CIA, I get that, but this just is so shady. Assassinations, you know, and then the story of Kennedy being right there, and he's lionized and he's idolized. He's kind of a martyr and a hero, and yet, that's got to hurt a little at some level.
I agree. I agree with you completely. I think the problem is, in a democracy, we should know all major aspects. I mean, it is true that you shouldn't know exactly who the agents we have in the Soviet Union or in foreign countries, their names or identities. But you should know the general direction of policy, and especially when you get into things of questionable morality, such as assassination. This should all be made pretty public. And in the 1960s, it was just completely the opposite. It was hidden. I say in the book that the CIA functioned then as sort of a Praetorian guard, and that was what the Caesars would have around them to protect them from being overthrown. And the Praetorian guard was loyal to the individual, not loyal to the empire or to the republic. And I think in the 60s, the CIA thought of itself that way, that it was loyal to John Kennedy, not loyal to the people of the United States of America.
Well, if the CIA thought of itself as a Praetorian Guard, I understand it's just a metaphor. They wouldn't have used those terms. But if they thought of themselves that way, the just as interesting a question is, did the president, John F. Kennedy, perceive a need for such an apparatus? Did he see himself as so vulnerable that he needed to make use of this to keep his regime in place?
All politics, presidents respond to politics, and Kennedy was especially sensitive to Cuba because of the state of Florida, and even as we've seen in this election, Cubans living in Florida wanting to oust Castro. And so, in addition to that, he had come under a lot of pressure for the Bay of Pigs failure and the fact that some 1,500 Cubans were captured there. So Kennedy was very sensitive to the need to get rid of Castro and also just to roll back communism. And he saw in the CIA and its secrecy the perfect way to do this without really tipping his hand and doing things the public might not accept.
I want to talk a little bit about strange bedfellows that crop up when you have these covert operations going on and maybe this, as you call it, a Praetorian Guard, the CIA. For the CIA to be trying to work through mobsters, is that par for the course?
It was, again, at the time, and it was very strange, and it embarrassed Kennedy because on several occasions the mobsters the CIA was working with ran afoul of the FBI and had to call off FBI investigations. Bobby Kennedy Jack Kennedy's brother was the Attorney General, and he was very big on clamping down on the underworld. And so it was pretty embarrassing to be running operations with the underworld on the one hand and trying to put them in prison on the other hand. And that came back to haunt the Kennedys.
So the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. I mean, I think of Bobby Kennedy and JFK as being fairly loyal to each other. But Bobby Kennedy was trying to clamp down on the mob at the same time his brother was maybe using them through the CIA?
Yes, I think, in fact, they then went to Bobby and they told Bobby what was going on. And Hoover went to him because J. Edgar Hoover was director of the FBI. He did not like the CIA. And when this all hit in 1962, Hoover made Bobby Kennedy, he had Bobby Kennedy briefed by the CIA. He had everybody reduce it to writing to Hoover to protect himself. And apparently that was the first time that Bobby Kennedy really realized that these underworld operations had been going on.
Now, there is some way – you talked earlier about circumstantial evidence about Oswald maybe having been guided or aided and abetted or even directed from the side of Cuba from Castro to pursue an assassination. After the assassination, did Castro ever say much about it or kind of take credit for it?
Just the opposite. He denied it. He gave public speeches that he was not involved. And in fact, he secretly agreed to meet secretly with the Warren Commission staff on a boat in the Caribbean to be interrogated by the Warren Commission. So he was certainly not willing to stand up and say he did this. I think, of course, had he done that, the United States would have invaded Cuba. That might well have triggered World War III, which is another reason national security reasons, sort of to cover this up.
Jim Johnston, author of Murder, Inc., The CIA Under John F. Kennedy. So you think that everything worth discovering has already been found, do you? Well, think again.
I had already noted that this octopus was behaving unlike any octopus I'd ever tried to photograph because it wasn't trying to attach itself to the sides of the aquarium or the bottom. It was floating in the middle of the aquarium. And when I looked at what were supposed to be suckers, they looked a lot more like light organs. So Sanka and I grabbed the octopus and took it into a dark room, turned out the lights, and sure enough, what we thought of as suckers were twinkling like light organs.
Shedding light on some surprising creatures from the Earth's deepest, darkest oceans tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.